Today on Maine Calling, the latest from the State House and the world of politics. Maine legislature is in its final weeks of the session and grappling with some difficult and controversial issues. From transgender athlete rights to mifepristone, they are debating bills at the heart of the national culture wars. Oh, and they also have a budget to pass. Meantime, the 2026 races for governor and Congress are shaping up to be pretty interesting, as several high-profile candidates have recently thrown their hats in the ring. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we check in with political reporters Kevin Miller and Susan Cover for an update on the world of Maine politics. And we'll hear from legislative leaders on both sides of the aisle. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling is made possible in part by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering health care, education, and support to islands and coastal Downeast communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org. And by Verrill, committed to delivering trusted legal services in Maine and throughout the Northeast for 163 years. Learn more at verrill-law.com.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. As the current legislative session heads to a close, we check in with two journalists who cover the State House every day. We'll also talk about who's in so far, the upcoming races for governor and Maine's 2nd Congressional District. With us today, Susan Cover, the State House reporter and multimedia content producer for Spectrum News, and Kevin Miller, Maine Public's State House correspondent. We invite you to join the conversation, share your thoughts on the political news of the day. You can do so by email, a brief email, please, talk@mainepublic.org. Again, talk@mainepublic.org. You can find us on social media or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Welcome back to both of you. I know we're in the final days of the legislative session, maybe 2.5 weeks left in theory. There are a flurry of high profile issues on the table. And the biggest, I think, or the most high profile is about whether transgender girls can participate in high school sports. We know that there was a public hearing a couple weeks ago. It focused on four different bills. Where are we today? Susan, I'll start with you. Are four bills still potentially law, or has it whittled down a little bit?
No, there are definitely still at least four bills, I would say, out there that are headed to the House and Senate. Two of those bills that seek to prohibit schools that receive state funds from allowing transgender girls to play on sports teams got 6-6 votes in the Judiciary Committee. Now, that was partly due to one Democrat attorney who recused himself from voting because his law firm does some work for the Maine Principals Association, and also due to a Democrat who voted with Republicans in support of these bills, Danny O'Hallen from Brewer. So they're closely divided. It was a very thoughtful and long work session, as you might expect. There were heartfelt comments on both sides, with legislators really grappling with where they should land on this issue. And, you know, two of the top bills, one will start in the House and one will start in the Senate. So we'll see where they go, you know, in the next 19 days.
And Kevin, do we have a sense of where they'll go? And if any of them are passed, whether the governor will sign them?
Yeah, we really don't have a sense on that right now. As Sue mentioned, they're tough issues, and they're not issues that fall exclusively along party lines. And I think especially once they get to the House, where Democrats only have a 3-seat majority. And this is an issue that, as we've talked about on the show before, there's a lot of division among people of all parties about where they stand on whether transgender athletes should be able to compete on girls' teams. So I think it's going to be interesting to see what happens when it hits the House. And then when it gets to the governor, you know, she's basically said at this point that it's a policy debate that the legislature should have, and that she'll take a look at it when it gets to her, if they get to her. And so that's kind of where we're at right now.
All right. Well, there are several bills as well concerning PFAS contamination. Of course, that's the forever chemicals found in so many products, including sludge that has been spread for a very long time on farmers' fields. Kevin, are any of these bills on track to become law? And if so, which ones?
Yeah, it looks like there's a pretty good chance that some of them will become law. One of the bills would require landlords to test their private wells for PFAS every 5 years. They're already required to do this for arsenic, so they'd have to add PFAS to that list. And that same legislation would also require that anyone who is selling a home would have to disclose whether their well has been tested for PFAS. And then there's a third bill that, or a second bill rather, that would require the state to help low-income residents pay for PFAS testing. As to whether they'll become law, I think there's a pretty good chance if they get to the governor because the governor's office didn't oppose them. But one thing that I think is interesting with PFAS that we're seeing is this used to be a pretty bipartisan issue because it's an issue that affects both rural areas and more urban areas. We're starting to see a little bit more of a political divide over it, and that's mostly because we're getting to the regulatory stage where Republicans were saying requiring landlords to test for PFAS is just, that's a $300 test at least. It's going to add to the cost of the landlords, and they're going to pass it on to the tenant. So at a time when we're talking about affordable housing, this is going to make housing potentially less affordable. So we're starting to see a little bit of a political divide on PFAS issues.
All right. Susan, we're also facing abortion legislation, specifically around the medication abortion drug mifepristone. What are legislators deciding?
So on this particular issue, the Democrats did pass a bill that would allow pharmacists to remove the name of a specific doctor or provider from the label and replace it with the name of the healthcare facility. Supporters say that this is necessary because Maine does continue to provide abortion services to folks from out of state who may be coming here from places where abortion is not legal at this point. Essentially, current state law requires, of course, all drug labels to include the name of the physician, and this is a carve-out that is specific to mifepristone and a couple of other abortion-related drugs.
Okay, and it's designed to protect physicians from some sort of action from another state.
Yes, because these shield laws have become more important in states like Maine, again, where, you know, we continue to allow abortion procedures to go forward. You know, we know about 30 states still do allow abortion, although the time frames in which a woman can seek an abortion vary quite a bit state by state. And of course, there are states who don't allow it at all and have been fairly aggressive in coming after physicians in other states who are providing services.
And Kevin, go ahead.
I'll just add, you know, this really isn't a hypothetical issue. We have, as Sue mentioned, we have seen some states. I think there was a case out of Louisiana where they went after a doctor in New York for prescribing one of these medication abortion pills. And New York has a shield law, and that case is considered, if it gets, of course, is considered to potentially be a test case in some of these shield laws.
And Kevin, I know earlier in the session, Republicans brought forward a number of bills that would limit access to abortion in Maine. Those bills all dead now?
Yeah, if they're not dead, they certainly will be soon. I mean, in this environment right now, Democrats are not, the vast, vast, vast majority of Democrats are not going to do anything that would further restrict access to abortion here in Maine. And
right.
Governor Mills certainly would not sign that.
Okay, Susan, I understand that we are looking at something that's referred to as the Part 2 budget. That's what still needs to be passed. Tell us what the issues are in this Part 2 budget, and maybe even before that, explain what we mean by a Part 2 budget.
Well, sure. In March, the Democrats passed what they're calling a continuing services budget. It's a little over $11 billion to provide money for state government for the next 2 years. So that's the vast, vast majority of the spending. But in doing so, they had about $100 million left over. And they have other issues to consider. You know, the governor had really wanted to extend her free community college from being a temporary program to being a permanent program. She also suggested perhaps raising taxes on cigarettes, you know, adding a dollar per pack on that. Those are issues that have yet to be resolved. Republicans held their weekly briefing yesterday and were quite critical of Democrats for not having a solid plan at this point, for not releasing a list of priorities, for not saying, exactly where all the funding is going to come from. When I ran that by Democrats, they said, this is all perfectly normal. We're working on it. We're being careful. We do know they need to provide more funding for Medicaid in the second year of the 2-year budget. So certainly that will definitely need to be addressed. And one interesting thing as we talk about 19 days left over was the House Chairman of the Appropriations Committee said, this is probably going to come together at the very last minute.
All right. Mid-June. Speaking of the governor will be term limited out. And Kevin, there are some people who want to take her place. And several of them have been making announcements. Who's in? Who's in the race for the governor, the Blaine House for 2026?
Yeah, so we got a couple of names out there so far. So on the Democratic side, we have Secretary of State Shenna Bellows. She's also a former state lawmaker and head of the Maine ACLU here in Maine. Former Senate President Troy Jackson, who's a logger from Allegash. He has officially thrown his name in. And then we have Angus King III, who is the son of our current senator and former governor Angus King. But there are still some other Democratic names that are out there that we're waiting to hear from. Shelley Pingree's daughter, Hannah Pingree, she recently stepped down from an office here at the state working for the Mills administration. A lot of speculation about that was a step down to step up into the governor's race. And then on the Republican side, we have Bobby Charles, who's a former assistant U.S. Secretary of State under Colin Powell. He worked in the Reagan White House and also on national security and counter-narcotics issues in Congress. And then the most recent person is Senator James Libby of Standish, who is a professor of business administration at Thomas College. And am I leaving anyone out there, Sue?
Well, David Jones, who's a real estate developer from Southern Maine, also announced a run. He's a Republican insider. He's, been on the national committee, been to the convention, and has raised a lot of money for Republican candidates in the past. So when I spoke to him, he was pretty optimistic that although he's not held elected office before, that he would have a good chance to win the nomination.
All right. Yeah, Kevin. Go ahead.
I should just add that when you look at, I checked this morning, and the Maine Ethics Commission, they receive paperwork filings for people who want to run. And I think there were 10 names on there. So the names that we put forward are just kind of some of the better known folks in politics.
And something I mentioned to you personally a few days ago is a friend of mine who lives in another state, New York State, received a fundraising appeal from Angus King III, which was interesting to me. Kevin, is that usual? Two things, that this early candidates in a primary would be fundraising out of state. Is that usual? And is that any indication of anything else?
Well, it's not unusual. I mean, fundraising is such a big, big thing right now. I mean, we do see more out-of-state fundraising on the congressional races than we do gubernatorial races, especially early on in this at this stage. But it takes money to run for office. So, I guess I wouldn't be surprised that they're already reaching out of state.
All right. And I want to return to the talking about Hannah Pingree for just a minute, Susan. Is the speculation that she will run for governor, is there any speculation she would run for something else? For example, challenge Senator Collins.
I have not heard that Hannah Pingree is interested in challenging Susan Collins. I certainly have heard that she would be a top contender in the governor's race. She's a former Speaker of the House, was well respected, did work across the aisle, and I think would be considered really a powerhouse in the Democratic primary.
Okay, well, speaking of somebody who is not running for governor, Congressman Jared Golden says he will not run for governor, but rather run for re-election in the 2nd Congressional District. And Susan, it looks like he is going to face a very interesting opponent, former Governor Paul LePage. So former Governor LePage has announced he's moving back to Maine to run. Do we know where he's going to live? And also, do you think this is why Golden made the decision he did?
Well, I don't know where Governor LePage is going to live. We know that he lived in the Boothbay Harbor region when he was here previously. And certainly he's going to be spending a lot of time further north, firmly in the 2nd Congressional District as he runs. I heard various things about Representative Golden and his decision-making process. I think he was concerned that if he did run for governor, he would have a difficult time making it through the Democratic primary. There were rumors maybe he'd run as an independent. And I think really when you look at his track record of winning the second congressional district several times in a row now, albeit by increasingly narrow margins, I'm sure the national Dems felt that that's really where he needed to stay.
And Kevin, will Jared Golden face a primary in the second congressional district?
Yeah, it's possible. Former Secretary of State Matt Dunlap, who's currently the state auditor, has kind of put a, his finger up there, kind of trying to gauge the wind about whether people would support him primarying Jared Golden. There are other names that have come up before, as we've talked about before. Congressman Golden, he's a pretty conservative Democrat on some issues. So and he's been fairly critical of his own party, especially the more progressive wing of his party. And that hasn't always sat well with the hardcore Democratic activist base in the state. So, but as of right now, Matt Dunlap is the only one who's put his name out there for potentially primarying Jared Golden.
And I'm guessing it's safe to predict that the second congressional district race for 2026 will likely be the most expensive congressional race in Maine history. Would you say that's probably right?
It's at least for House seat, probably. I mean, it's already that district consistently every 2 years is the most expensive. And if it is Jared Golden versus Paul LePage, I mean, that's going to be just a huge fight that's going to draw a lot of national money. And the national parties, they always look at this race as a key swing district. And if you have those two gentlemen at the top of the ticket, there's going to be a lot of money.
And speaking of the 2026 race, I need to ask you, Susan, any idea who might challenge Senator Collins?
Well, we do have Jordan Wood, who has announced he's running as a Democrat in the primary, if there is a primary, a Democratic primary. I've also heard former State Senator Kathy Breen mentioned as someone who might be jumping in to a Democratic race for the U.S. Senate against Susan Collins. And there is an independent named Philip Wrench as well. And I think we're really just waiting to see who else might jump in. By all accounts, Governor Mills may still be mulling it, although she's made pretty clear, I think, that she's not necessarily interested in running, but she hasn't ruled it out. And I think it's had really the effect of kind of freezing the field for particularly other prominent Democrats who might have been thinking of jumping in. But certainly, if Governor Mills were to run, she's got, the highest profile and probably the best chance of beating Susan Collins.
There's so many more questions I have for both of you, especially about how the big, beautiful bill, I think that's what big, beautiful budget that President Trump is supporting would affect Maine. But we do need to go to a break. We're also going to hear from legislative leadership on both sides of the aisle. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today we are discussing the latest news from the State House and also how federal policy may affect Maine. With me, Sue Cover, Spectrum News State House reporter and multimedia content producer, and Maine Public's Kevin Miller, our State House correspondent. You can share your comments and questions by email, talk@mainepublic.org, comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Calling in now is Senator Maddie Daughtry, who is president of the Maine Senate. She is a Democrat from Brunswick, representing parts of Cumberland County. Senator Daughtry, thanks so much for giving us a call.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, we keep hearing this 19 days left. In those, first of all, do you think you'll make deadline? And second of all, what are your priorities in these last 2.5 weeks?
I think we are on track to finish on time or as close as possible. We've been moving paper at a breakneck pace, and Speaker Fecteau and I have tried out several new methods for both our committees and our chambers to be really efficient and make sure that, we are responsive to the work that we have to get done. I mean, one of the things that I'm excited is at the beginning of this week, committees had voted out over 95% of their bills, which compared to last session at this time, we were only at 79%. So that's a significant increase. I think the biggest priorities is making sure that we're keeping our commitments to Maine, looking at a part two budget, as I know you guys were discussing earlier in the session, and, you know, just trying to get out on time. We have a lot of, you know, big weighty issues in front of us, and we're shifting from being in committees to having those conversations on the floor.
All right. And let me ask you, is there any common ground with Republican colleagues right now? And if so, on what issues?
Absolutely. I think there actually is always, and I have said this since I got into this building, and even now in this political environment, there is more that, you know, brings us together than divides us. It's just very easy to focus sort of on the rancor and the divide. I think about the fact that the majority of the bills that we pass through our committees are bipartisan. Many of them are unanimous. And I look at even my own bills. My property tax bill, LD 1770, had not only bipartisan sponsorship, but we had Democrats and Republicans testifying in favor, and it had a unanimous report out of tax. So yes, there are some big splashy issues that, you know, really, you know, don't bring us together. But the majority of it, and the challenge that I've been issuing since, you know, I was sworn in as Senate president, is we all agree when we want to move Maine forward. We just don't agree on which path or what roadmap to get there. So where can we find that common ground in between?
All right. I'm going to turn to Kevin Miller. Kevin, go ahead.
Yeah. Hi, President Daughtry. Thanks for joining us. So I guess we were talking obviously about the budget process and the part two of this budget. And I know you're not, you're obviously involved in discussions and negotiations, but it's mostly in the committee. I was just wondering to get a sense from you. There's so many of these issues that even the governor put forward as far as, you know, tax increases on tobacco tax, streaming services, making some changes to Medicaid to make it more sustainable over the future. Where do you feel like your caucus stands on those really kind of more difficult issues right now?
We're definitely also having those conversations, and many of those items that were in the governor's proposal also were related to standalone bills. So we, you know, not only as a caucus, but as leadership, have been able to look at the public input on those individual measures, whether it was in front of appropriations or our policy committees, and really trying to see what fits with what Mainers want. And I think the...
Oh, shoot. Sorry about that. I made a mistake there. Darn it. Senator Daughtry, I hope you can call back. I went to click on Representative Billy Bob Fockingham a bit early. Oh, there we go. Senator Daughtry, thank you so much. I'm sorry about that. I just cut you off. Could you repeat your last line?
Absolutely. I'm not sure where I got cut off on there. I was just going to say that, you know, a lot of these measures that were in the governor's proposal not only were part of the appropriations conversations with public input, but also many had standalone bills. So, you know, we as a caucus and as leadership are reviewing the different measures, seeing what really fits and works for Mainers in our districts and going from there. And I know appropriations is working hard to figure out what is going to be part of the part two. The challenge that I've been issuing not only to my caucus, but to my colleagues, is we have to think about what the impact of all these measures are on the average Mainer. We need to make life better for Mainers, not harder. So how can we keep our commitments, make sure that we are keeping people's health care, providing education, but also making sure that people can afford to thrive and live here in Maine?
Senator Daughtry, thank you so much for calling in. Maddie Daughtry is Maine Senate President. And as I just alluded to, on the line with us now is State Legislator Billy Bob Fockingham, a Republican from Winter Harbor, and House Minority Leader Representative Fockingham. Welcome back to Maine Calling.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on again.
Yeah, and I'll ask you the same question I asked Senator Daughtry. With 19 days left, are you confident you all will make deadline? And also, what are your priorities in this final stretch of the legislative session?
I feel pretty good about it. Of course, my party's not in charge of running the calendar and making sure that we get through the work, but we're doing our part to make sure that we meet that deadline. The Republicans are in their seats at 10 a.m., ready to work every day. I'm incredibly proud of my caucus and how we've been working efficiently. And even though we sometimes disagree with the Democrats on a lot of things, that we're working towards that goal of getting out of there on time.
And I'll ask you another question I also asked Senator Daughtry. Is there common ground between the two parties right now? What are you all working on together?
Well, you know, I mean, there is actually a lot of stuff we do agree on. I think the majority of the bills will see unanimous reports of either ought to pass or ought not to pass. So there's a lot of agreement in the committees. The committee work is really where the sausage making happens. That's where I think sitting beside each other in those horseshoes, and there's more camaraderie there in the committees. So, yeah, there is a lot of agreement there. It's just that a lot of focus gets on the things we're divided on. And when we're divided on things, we fight for those passionately. But there are things that I think that we can get done together. I'm just a little bit concerned about the time that we have left and some of the stuff that is unfinished right now. We know that there was a $120 million budget shortfall, the budget that we're currently under, the so-called continuing services budget, remains unbalanced. There's $120 million in healthcare shortfall that's not funded in the second year of that. We haven't seen a budget document come yet from the Democrats that's going to show how they plan on paying for that. So we're still waiting for that. There's less than 3 weeks left, and my appropriations members haven't been presented with that proposal or that solution from the Democrats. So we're still waiting to see what comes there. We're a little bit upset that we haven't taken care of this. Of course, it's a national problem, but it's a really big issue here in the state of Maine, the biological males and girls sports and how we're going to sort that out with the transgender athletes. And, I heard you guys talking about it earlier. And there may be some people out there that don't necessarily show the compassion that we'd like to see. But certainly I know among my caucus, there is a lot of compassion out there for these transgender athletes. And we don't want to exclude them from being able to participate in sports. But we do align with 70% of the Maine people who don't think that biological males should be competing against girls in girls' sports. So we would really like to see a solution happen there before we're out of session. We're getting close to the end of session. So we do know that we have bipartisan support on that issue. So that's somewhere we can work together. But we need to see that bill come out of the committee and come to the floor so that we can get to take action on that. And our girls should be protected in their opportunities and their spaces. And so that's something we want to see happen before we adjourn.
Got it. Susan.
Yes, Representative, one of the issues you mentioned yesterday during your briefing was energy prices. And I did notice that the committee voted out some net energy billing bills yesterday. I'm wondering if the compromise that the committee reached there is something that you think is going to help folks on the ground.
Oh, wow. I sat in that committee until after 10 a.m. watching the committee members work. And it was really frustrating to see one after the other these solar people come up there and, I'm just going to say complain and cry about these very minor cuts to these huge profits. I mean, some of these companies have doubled in size since 2019 when the net energy billing law took its current form. And they're making so much money that they're offering people $500 incentives to sign up. It's just crazy how much this is costing the people of Maine. So I know that the committee was working on a very minor proposal, and that's something that we have really focused on. This is going to cost Maine ratepayers over $200 million annually, and there's really no need of it to be paying in excess of 20 cents a kilowatt hour when this energy should really be less than 10 cents a kilowatt hour. It's a crazy program. We made a mistake when we passed it, and that's something Republicans have absolutely been focused on. And I think something might come out of there that will help a little tiny bit, but it's nowhere near what we were looking for on that.
All right. Well, Representative Fockingham, I really appreciate you calling in. Billy Bob Fockingham is the Republican minority leader for the Maine House of Representatives. And Susan, I'm going to go back to you and just have you explain a little bit. I know net energy billing, we've done pretty much a whole program on it, but where are we and what might happen?
Well, yeah, the Energy and Utilities Committee has been working on these bills for several months. The public advocate has been involved. She has been interested in tweaking the program, not scrapping it for sure, but in making it so that small businesses aren't getting large electricity bills because of the subsidies provided, to try to spark solar companies to come here and build their projects. So we're going to see how those bills officially come out of committee in the next few days, and I'm sure they'll be hotly debated on the floor.
All right. Well, as promised, I do want to talk about the budget that's working its way through Congress and how it might affect Maine. And I'm going to turn back to you, Susan. You have reported on its potential impact on Planned Parenthood. And somebody might not realize that Planned Parenthood is far more than an abortion provider here in Maine.
Yeah, for sure. There are four health clinics across the state, and they provide services, including sexually transmitted disease detection and treatment, cancer screenings, contraception, and of course, abortion care. And in the big bill that the U.S. House passed last week is specific language that would prohibit Planned Parenthood from participating in the Medicaid program. So, if they provide services to someone who comes in who has Medicaid for insurance, they wouldn't get reimbursed for that care. And in Maine, they provide services to about 7,000 people a year, and nearly 30% of those are on MaineCare. So, they held a briefing earlier this week to talk about potential impacts to them and are very concerned that down the line, if they aren't able to recoup this money for services provided, that they may have to reduce hours or close clinics, some of which are in rural areas.
And Kevin, what are some of the other ways in which this congressional spending bill might affect Maine?
Yeah, it would affect us in so many different ways, kind of building on what Sue just talked about. I mean, one of the ways that Republicans want to pay for the tax cuts is by reducing spending elsewhere, and a big part of that is in Medicaid. I think it's close to 400,000, between 300,000 and 400,000 Mainers are on Medicaid, which is what we call MaineCare. And the bill would make some changes. It would add work requirements. It would make other changes to try to go after, especially the states that expanded Medicaid coverage under Obamacare. So that would potentially have a major impact on tens of thousands of Mainers here. It also would make some potential changes to the VA system. We have a lot of veterans here. But then if you look at I guess what the Republicans say is the more positive sides, this would be expanding the 2017 tax cuts. A lot of analysis out there, it's still trying to figure out exactly what the impact would be, but it seems like middle income Mainers would probably see either a tax decrease under this. Certainly wealthier Mainers would see a tax decrease. The question is, especially if folks on the lower end, they might see a tax decrease, but if they're losing access to Medicaid, they're losing access to other services, kind of how does that play out in the long run? So the tax provisions are really still, we're trying to figure out how that's going to impact states.
And Kevin, what about all the federal lawsuits we've discussed before that involve Maine? You've been keeping track of them. List the big
Yeah,
ones
trying
and tell us
to.
where they are.
Yeah, I've been trying to keep track of them. I mean, Maine's Attorney General has signed on to a whole bunch of lawsuits with other states challenging some of the Trump administration's actions. But then we have these separate lawsuits that are specific to Maine. The Department of Justice sued the state over the issue of transgender athletes. That's still in the courts. That's going to probably play out for months and months. The hearing schedule on that is pretty extended. We also have the lawsuit filed by former Representative Laurel, or excuse me, Representative Laurel Libby of Auburn. She sued the House Speaker after the House censured her. She has since gotten back the right to vote on the House floor because the U.S. Supreme Court came in and said no, she should be able to vote. But that lawsuit is still pending. We have I've running short on what the other lawsuits are. We have the Department of Education lawsuit was settled. Sorry, the USDA lawsuit was settled.
Right,
Sue?
which brought money back to the University of Maine system and in some other places.
Right.
All right, well, if you have, we do have to go to another break. I'm saying to the audience, if you have questions for Susan or Kevin or thoughts about what you've heard so far, give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org or very quickly post on Facebook or Instagram. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling, our topic today. Well, Politics. Joining me, my Maine Public colleague, Kevin Miller and Sue Cover with Spectrum News. If you'd like to join the conversation, you have a few minutes, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org. Kevin, before the break, we were talking about the lawsuits that Maine, the state is involved in, and you ran out of steam, but since you've remembered a couple more.
Yeah, there's just too many of them that are hard to keep track of. So there's some of the other lawsuits out that are still out there. There's a lawsuit challenging Maine's 72-hour waiting period on gun purchases. That's at the federal court level. We also have some legislation here in this at the State House that would seek to roll back that 72-hour waiting period. I don't really see that going anywhere right now, probably with the lawsuits still pending. But then there's this other big lawsuit that involves the referendum that Maine passed last year involving campaign contributions to super PACs. And these are the political action committees that make independent expenditures. We capped it at $5,000 per person to super PACs. That's being challenged in federal courts. And the interesting thing about that is the thought is that actually could make it, and the goal is actually for this to end up before the U.S. Supreme Court. And kind of it's challenging an aspect of the Citizens United ruling from more than a decade ago that's been so controversial.
All right, we're going to go to Lewis, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Lewis, go ahead.
Oh, thanks so much for taking my call. I just wanted to, first of all, great show so far, and I'm glad that we're focused on this topic. I wanted to point out that this Sunday, June 1st, is the 75th anniversary of Senator Margaret Chase Smith's Declaration of Conscience speech on the floor of the U.S. Senate, which was her way of standing up to the bullying tactics of her fellow Republican and colleague Joseph McCarthy during the height of the Red Scare. And I just wanted to quote two sentences from that speech. She said, "It is high time that we stopped thinking politically as Republicans and Democrats about elections and started thinking patriotically as Americans about national security based on individual freedom. It is high time that we all stopped being tools and victims of totalitarian techniques that, if continued here unchecked, will surely end what we have come to cherish as the American way of life." 15 years ago, in 2010, Senator Susan Collins and then Senator Olympia Snowe co-sponsored a resolution to just kind of remember that speech and declared June 1st as a Declaration of Conscience Day. So now, 15 years later, I would really love to see our Senator Collins, follow in the footsteps of her hero, Margaret Chase Smith, and just speak out more forcefully against what's happening in the executive branch. And this doesn't mean I don't think necessarily opposing all of his policy agendas, the president's policy agendas, but more just showing some outrage and repudiation of how Trump is ignoring the Constitution, the rule of law, and habeas corpus, and just the way he's going about things. And I think Susan Collins has, she's spoken out against the cuts to National Institute of Health. She's started to do some, speaking out against what President Trump is doing, but I would love for her to use June 1st as a reminder of her hero's legacy and just speak out more forcefully against.
Lewis, thanks so much for calling in. Yeah, and Susan, I don't think Lewis is the only person who wishes Senator Collins would say more forcefully. Have you talked to Senator Collins about this? Have you heard from those who are close to her about how she's thinking about her service during this administration?
I haven't spoken with the senator, but I know she has released public statements expressing disappointment and concern, of course, about a lot of the funding cuts. She's been pretty specific on Medicaid in particular, saying that if it harms low-income families or children, that she would definitely take a strong stand against that. And as we know, the big tax bill is headed to the Senate next, where we expect it to be amended significantly. And certainly, you know, to the caller's point, I think a lot of Mainers, particularly Democrats who've been critical of the senator, have wanted her to take stronger, more forceful stands on a lot of issues. And I think that's, you know, going to be one of those ways that the Democrats try to go at her when we, you know, roll into the election next year.
Kevin, thoughts?
Yeah, and that's I fully expect this will be a core part of the Democratic campaign against Senator Collins, if and when we do get a Democratic candidate that's running against her. It seems like at this point, her philosophy has mostly been to try to reverse individual issues with what the Trump administration is doing, to restore funding to programs, to put pressure on them to not do things that they say they're going to do. But I know a lot of Democrats are just basically saying that's not enough. We need something more forceful. And Senator Angus King actually did come out with his own version of the Declaration of Conscience speech, I believe it was last month. And he, in that speech, he called Trump one of the biggest threats to the U.S. Constitution in our history. And, you know, he really called on Republicans to step up. You know, he certainly didn't name Susan Collins, but you know, called on Republicans in general to step up to do more to push back against Trump.
All right, Lewis, thank you for your call. We're going to go to Falmouth and Rachel. Hi, Rachel, go ahead.
Hi. So I'm going back to an issue you discussed a little earlier in the program. It's the issue of transgender athletes. And I was an athlete. I was a high school athlete back in the 1970s before there was women's teams for everything. And I was a runner. And I ran with the boys' team, and that was fine. I was just unofficial. And I always wondered, you know, we would go to races, and there would always be one or two other women running at these other schools. And I think they were all in hopes of developing women's teams, you know, the coaches and stuff. And I always wondered why it was so, why they couldn't at least give us a score and a place, you know what I mean? And say, well, this is the top female runner and this is second and third place or whatever. And nowadays, when there's large races, like a marathon, for example, the men and women, you know, run together and they are running for different age groups. They're in different age groups. They're in all these different classes. And, you know, there's people who are handicapped that are running, right? There's all these different classes. Why is it not possible to simply allow transgender athletes to perform alongside either male or female athletes and just have it scored as a different category until there's such a time that there's enough people to have teams, which I actually don't think would happen. There's actually very few transgender athletes, but the real focus for K-12 especially shouldn't be who wins. The real focus should be just be the development that you're giving that child and the exposure to sports and to competition.
Yeah, Rachel, you've got so many points there. And, you know, we have an email here from Maggie who is kind of on the same wavelength that you are. Maggie writes, what percentage of trans girls play sports in Maine? I imagine less than 1%. Instead of legislators determining this issue, girls playing sports and trans girls should be heard. Perhaps instead of a ban on trans girls, might have some sort of handicap to level the playing field. Think the actual students should have a voice. Both of your comments really illustrate that this is complicated. You know, what you're saying, Rachel, about maybe another class or category would work, I'm guessing, better for individual sports than team sports. Susan, as you've covered these hearings, are these the kind of conversations that are happening?
Well, they aren't yet, but I do suspect that they could. And one of the bills that is under consideration came from Representative Liz Caruso, and she suggested having co-ed teams. And as you know, one of your folks mentioned, there probably wouldn't be enough people to field teams between schools. And so that was a concern, or funding for coaches for separate teams. Certainly, I think all things are on the table, and those who support transgender participation say, it really is about high school sports. It's about creating bonds and friendship, and it's not so much about who's winning or losing. It's about giving everyone a chance to develop in high school and to create those bonds that you can only create, when you're a teenager, and not so much about winning and losing.
Kevin, thoughts? I mean, it is so interesting because there's so many values that we hold dear as Americans, and one of those is fairness in terms of winning and losing, but another one is letting kids be kids. And these are really important core values that are at a little bit of odds for many people.
Yeah, they are, and I think that's why you there is this kind of uncomfortableness and opposition among some large numbers of people here. I think the most recent poll that we saw was about 70% of Maine people that participated in this poll opposed allowing transgender athletes to participate in girls' sports. And during the, I mean, the marathon public hearing that we had on these bills, we saw high school students testifying on both sides of this issue. We had, girls who lost places on podiums because they were defeated by a transgender athlete come up and say, "Look, this is not fair to me. I worked hard to get here, and there's just a biological difference. I can't compete with this other individual." But then we saw girls taking the even from I think Colby College and other college student athletes coming forward and say, "No, I've competed with transgender athletes and I welcome them to our team." So even within the high school community, you see this division.
Yeah, Rachel, thank you so much for your call. Gary on Facebook writes, "I wonder why Paula Page decided to run in Maine and not Florida." Kevin, is that just a straight political calculation? Does he think he'd have a better chance of winning here?
Well, he's very well known up here in Maine. I don't think he's terribly well known down in Florida. So, and there's obviously a lot of other folks in Florida that are running for offices. But he definitely has a lot of name recognition, has a lot of support among the Republican base up here. And when you're looking at the second district, it's a more conservative district. So he's obviously thinking that he's going to probably do better than, say, Bruce Poliquin or Austin Terrio. Did against Jared Golden because he has that bigger name recognition.
An email here from Lori. Are the panelists hearing anything from state legislators regarding how federal immigration policy is impacting Maine, specifically the ICE present and impact on ICE presence and impact on tourism?
That's interesting. I haven't heard anything about the impact on tourism by on the immigration front. Certainly, we've seen a few people that have been detained, seeing increasing numbers of that, and that's getting a lot of attention. One thing that might be interesting to watch is how this does affect our workforce, because we do have certain industries that are heavily dependent on new Mainers. And these are folks who either are refugees or asylum seekers. And once they get their work permits, they work in some of the healthcare fields. They work in some of the hospitality fields. So if there is this chilling effect on these folks coming in or being willing to work, that could have an effect on that. But certainly we're seeing impacts on Canadian tourists coming here. And obviously we're probably going to see continue to see that over the summer.
Yeah, and a lot of discussion about tariffs and where they land and their impact on Maine businesses. But Susan, I'm wondering if the a snowball effect is there's the impact on Maine businesses, but then is there an impact on tax revenue in Maine?
Well, there certainly could be. Although I was encouraged over the weekend that despite our continued poor weather, we did have better than expected tourism numbers in Maine. Old Orchard seemed plenty busy. And, tax revenues, as far as what businesses are able to pay into the state, certainly are being watched very closely. We recently had a revenue reprojection, and they'll be meeting again in the fall to try to see where things are going to land.
All right. Well, I so appreciate both of you being willing to come on to Maine Calling on a Friday afternoon, so or Friday morning, almost afternoon. Thank you so much, Sue Cover, State House reporter and multimedia content producer for Spectrum News, and Kevin Miller, Maine Public State House correspondent. Today's sound engineer, Jess Miller. Our theme music was composed by Mike Jandro. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Every Friday afternoon, we send out the Maine Calling newsletter. In the newsletter, you can find out what kind of shows we're working on for the next week. You can also learn some links, web links, and facts about the shows from the previous week. You can sign up for that by going to mainecalling.org. It is free and easy. Again, mainecalling.org. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.